Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with Liesl Schillinger about a most unusual first novel.
You're pulled into the drama just through the incredible natural beauty of her writing and the humanity of the everyday situations of these housewives in Virginia.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Times columnist Thomas Edsel leads us through the complications of economic inequality.
It's actually a more elaborate argument than just rich people stamping their own goals onto politics.
And Greg Coles has bestseller news. Here at the Book Review, we're never happier than when an interesting first novel comes our way. And there is a most unusual one, beginning with its title, Shine, Shine, Shine. The author is Lydia Netzer, and it's reviewed for us by one of our favorites, and we suspect one of yours, Liesl Schillinger, who's here to talk about it. Welcome, Liesl.
Hi, Sam.
Okay, so we have a couple of interesting storylines in Netzer's novel. Lay it out just as simply as you can.
Well, a man is on a rocket to the moon, which he's going to colonize. He's a kind of astronaut and math geek, brilliant guy. Meanwhile, his wife is back home in Virginia, and she is about to bear their second child. Their first child is a boy named Bubber, who's a little autistic, or kind of a lot autistic. And she herself was born during a lunar eclipse in Burma. And also, while all this is going on, the woman's mother is in a hospital dying of cancer, but the daughter is in denial that that's happening.
Well, that all sounds kind of plausible.
Now, simple, right?
There is... I believe Netzer's husband is a mathematician, and so is the husband in this novel. And does she write about that in an informed or serious-minded way?
Oh, she certainly does. You know, and this book takes place in Virginia. The woman in the novel is named Sunny Maxson. Actually, her maiden name is Butcher. But she lives in a kind of perfect cookie-cutter community in a Georgian mansion in Norfolk, Virginia. And everyone who lives there seems very conscientious in modern America, and they have the wives have their SUVs, their husbands have their German sedans. Everyone is kind to each other. It's a very thoughtful community. And Netzer herself has two children and lives in Virginia and homeschools her children. And her husband, as you said, is a mathematician. So I do get a feeling that she is writing what she knows in this book. And there are lots of ruminations that are deftly and wittily done, not heavy-handedly, that bring the math and science into this in almost a poetic way.
And how does she keep these two storylines going? Is there communication between Sunny and her husband, who is in the rocket, or are those stories kept separate?
Well, there really can't be too much communication between them because, as you say, he is in a rocket in outer space. He actually gets cut loose from his rocket, and so he's just kind of floating around, and there's a question, will he or won't he get back to Earth? And so she gets calls from NASA, which she fields every now and then, but she's got her own troubles. But, you know, before going into all of this, I want to say that the strange miracle of this book is it's not depressing, it's not heavy-handed, it's not weird. This doesn't read like Pynchon. This is a very subtle book, and you're pulled into the drama just through the incredible natural beauty of her writing and the humanity of the everyday situations of these housewives in Virginia that Lydia is writing about. So you are tricked into a deeper story than you think you might get, but it also doesn't feel like it's artificially constructed. This is just, it's really moving to read it.
That's really quite remarkable for a first novel, isn't it? We're so used to the first novel that's kind of autobiographical, but the late and now, you know, so recently departed Gore Vidal, once called Last Summer at Rutgers, the first novel about the life you led up till the time you wrote the novel. And here Netzer seems to be aiming for something really quite ambitious and, as you say, intensely literary. Your review begins by showing how some of the prose could actually be recast in the cadences of romantic poetry.
Much of the prose, in fact. And do you want me to read that first line?
Sure, go ahead.
The story begins, and the reader doesn't really know what's going on. And I'm going to tell the listener, just so they're not confused, that this is describing Sunny's husband, who is name is Maxon, and he is in, floating in space. And it begins, "Deep in darkness there was a tiny light. Inside the light he floated in a spaceship. It felt cold to him, floating there. Inside his body he felt the cold of space." And when she goes on and develops this story, this little capsule, she's really comparing sending a man into space to colonize the moon with the miracle of conception. So that's why I say there's a real metaphysical quality to this writing. And there's also a lot of dark humor in it. And I just feel that Lydia Netzer had a very particular truth to communicate, a very particular experience to communicate. She is a quirky person. I think her mind is very nimble. So must be her husband's, the mathematicians. And the nimbleness of this book shows that. One other thing is, you know, she is completely bald. She has alopecia, which is a rare condition, particularly for women.
This is Sunny, not
Sunny,
Netzer.
The woman. Oh, yeah. No, not, excuse me. I meant Sunny, her character. And when you meet her, you just think she's a Stepford wife because she's so blonde in this perfect smooth granite kitchen talking with her girlfriends. And like before you're 30 pages in, you're finding out, no, she was born in Burma during a total eclipse. Her mother rebelled against her older husband, who was a pastor. She's a very unconventional person. And that smooth blonde hair she has is a wig. She is completely bald. And so this book is all about not trusting surface appearances and not thinking that anything that looks slick and boring is as simple and easily assimilable as you might think.
Now, Lisa, what about the autistic child? Autism is one of those topics that's so much in the air today. It's talked about so much. So many more children seem to be afflicted with it than we thought even a few years ago. How does Netzer handle that very sensitive subject?
Really masterfully, what comes across first in this book is the mother and father's love for their child, whom they call Bubbert, though his name is Robert. And the kid is 4 years old. They have him at a school where he's mainstreamed with other children, but the school staff want her to medicate the child more, so he acts up less. And the mother rebels against that dousing of the personality of her child. She's making an argument for nonconformism and for respecting the differences of people, but she's not underestimating the difficulty of autism. But one thing that becomes really interesting toward the last end of the book is that a lot of the scientists she is talking with at NASA, you know, as her husband is floating in the ether of the universe, they also have Asperger's-like conditions. And so there's a question of whether autism or Asperger's is not maybe some new troubled evolutionary step. If you're really good at abstract thinking, if you're really good at math and science, maybe there's a new kind of person that is developing. And in our increasingly technological world, people talk sometimes about technolution, the idea that our brain and our wiring is changing as the technologies that we incorporate in our lives are changing. The phenomenon of autism, I think, is going to happen more and not less, and Asperger's. And she has a very colorful way of making you feel the humanity involved in this neurological condition.
Liesl, for readers who are coming to Netzer for the first time and this most unusual novel, mm-hmm. is there any author that she might remind them of or that she reminded you of in this first work of fiction?
You know, I've seen people who say that her style reminds them of Anne Tyler. I certainly love Anne Tyler, and I think that she is as tricky and limber in her view of the family as Anne Tyler is. But she reminded me a little bit more of Don DeLillo because there is an allegorical quality to what she's writing that really captured my imagination. And to take that thought even further, last week I saw at Central Park the brilliant production of Into the Woods, which is a musical by Sondheim and James Lapine. And that musical starts out seeming to be a fairy tale, but in the second act, you realize it's actually a metaphor for death, for love affairs, for humiliation, for embarrassment, for things that people suffer with and struggle with when they get off the straight path, which life almost never lets you stay on the straight path. That musical is highly metaphorical about the fairy tale quality of the alleys life leads us into. And this book works very much the same way.
Thanks so much, Liesl.
Sure. Thanks, then.
That's Liesl Schillinger, who reviews Shine, Shine, Shine by Lydia Netzer in this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So another ascendant or ascending literary star fizzles a little bit.
A little bit is an understatement. As many of our listeners, I'm sure, are aware, Jonah Lehrer, the New Yorker staff writer, resigned this week very publicly after it was discovered that he had made some journalistic errors, to say the least, in his best-selling book, Imagine.
A number one best-selling book, I believe, in our list.
And it was currently, I believe, number 13 in the latest list. And that list reflects sales that ended the week of July 28th. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens next week.
Well, what's the publisher doing about this? I mean, because the story, if I understand it, is that Jonah Lehrer admitted to an interviewer that he had fabricated some material in this latest book. Is that right? And how did the publisher react to that?
Right. Well, actually, the story goes back to June. Well, first of all, Jonah Lehrer is a 31-year-old. He got his undergrad at Columbia in neuroscience. He was a Rhodes Scholar after that. And then he went very quickly from being, you know, a smart undergrad, a Rhodes Scholar, to blogging and writing about brain science and among other topics. He wrote for Seed Magazine. He wrote for Wired. He started a very popular blog and, of course, became very active on the lecture circuit, talking to corporate audiences about business and science and ideas in kind of a Malcolm Gladwell mold.
Lehrer's first book, Proust Was a Neuroscientist, was actually quite well received and also very successful. What was the area that he had been working in, Lehrer? Is it really taking this very hot field of neuroscience and explaining how it affects our everyday lives? What was his specialty?
That was his specialty, to, you know, take examples from the field of neuroscience and use it to, you know, explain our everyday lives, how people make decisions and how creativity works, which is, you know, of course, been an incredibly popular field for the last 10 years and, you know, what people are interested in reading about in The New Yorker and other publications. So Jonah Lehrer started writing books. He's written three books now. And in June, I believe it was a tipster to Jim Romanesco, who writes the very popular media gossip site, who pointed out that in one of Jonah Lehrer's blog posts for The New Yorker.
And he had just really begun at The New Yorker,
yeah,
right?
He had written a few pieces, but he was just hired as a staff writer in June of this year. But he had written a lot for a blog there, the blog that came over from Wired to The New Yorker, that was his blog.
He took his blog from Wired magazine, the techie magazine, over to The New Yorker.
That's right. So what this reader pointed out was that Jonah Lehrer had been recycling some of his older material from the Wall Street Journal, from the New York Times, from Wired, and then reusing it in the New Yorker. And these were posts that appeared on the website, so they wouldn't have gone through the famously rigorous fact-checking department that operates for the print side of the New Yorker magazine. So basically what he had done was he borrowed from his own work. He was reusing, you know, from older work, anecdotes, paragraphs.
Wasn't he actually essentially just reproducing entire chunks of work that had appeared not all that long before? Is that right?
Right. And some of this was practically verbatim. And after that became known, other people kind of started digging. And, you know, someone pointed out that, for instance, in a piece that had appeared in The New Yorker, Lehrer had quoted Noam Chomsky, but he made it appear that he had talked to Noam Chomsky when actually he didn't, and it was just something that he said in another interview.
That Chomsky had said?
Yes.
Chomsky, the great, great linguist. Yeah, I see. I see.
So that would have been also, you know, you don't take a quote and make it appear that you interviewed the person. You have to properly attribute it. So little things like that began to appear, but he did hold on to his job at The New Yorker, apparently, even though the editor of The New Yorker, David Remnick, was very reluctant to keep him on.
And so what's the next chapter? Because now we've gone beyond his recycling of his own material, we've come into another area with this latest episode.
So this week on Tablet Magazine, which is an online magazine of Jewish culture, an intellectual magazine, published a piece on Monday that was by Michael Moynihan. And Michael Moynihan wrote that he had read Jonah Lear's most recent book, Imagine, which came out in March, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And Moynihan realized reading the very first chapter that some of the Bob Dylan quotes that Jonah Lear had reprinted didn't seem right to him. Now, Moynihan is one of millions of people in this country of Bob Dylan obsessive. He knows a lot about what Bob Dylan has written and said. And he thought, look, I've never heard of any of these quotes, and some of this doesn't sound right. And he went to Jonah Lear and asked him what his sources were. And Lear, when pressed over a period of several weeks, he first claimed that he had been given access to some kind of archive by Bob Dylan's manager that no one else had access to. He claimed that, you know, there was part of an unreleased interview with Bob Dylan. And then after several weeks, Jonah finally admitted to Michael Moynihan that it was not true, that he couldn't find the places where these quotes were, and that some of these quotes actually didn't exist.
So it's almost the familiar case of the crime, if we'll call it that, being bad enough, but the cover-up even worse.
Right. And when you read the account of the way that Jonah Lear tried to cover this up, you know, it does bring to mind other famous fabricators in journalism. Jason Blair, who, of course, was the reporter for the New York Times, Janet Cook from the Washington Post. When caught, they start to make up a lot of crazy stories, and then those stories kind of build onto the next one, and it does not look good.
Now, Julie, as you point out, if you're going to invent a quote by somebody, why on earth would you choose Bob Dylan, who, let's be fair, and I am belong to the army not of Dylan obsessives, who know like the contents of his pantries and garbage pails. There are some of those. But an enormous fan of the music, and I'm aware, as many others are, that there are people who actually know everything this man ever wrote and said. Why would you choose him? Is it because Jonah Lehrer doesn't really know that much about Dylan? Is this possible?
That's one theory. I mean, he is only 31 years old. It's possible that he is too young to really understand the impact that Bob Dylan has had and how many Dylanologists there are out there who have parsed every word that the great man has ever uttered, looking for meaning. I would think that if one would fabricate a quote about any other person, you would be on safer territory doing it if that person is no longer alive. Bob Dylan is, of course, alive and quite able to say, no, I didn't say that.
And has he said that? Has Dylan reacted at all? He probably doesn't even care.
Right? He probably doesn't care. Dylan's manager, Jeff Rosen, declined to comment and hasn't made any on-the-record statements to anyone that I've seen. So, however, Michael Moynihan from Tablet, who wrote the piece, managed to get in touch with Dylan's manager when he was researching this. And, you know, Jonah Lear was saying, oh, well, I talked to, you know, Dylan's manager and they gave me all access to all these archives. Michael Moynihan went to them and they did confirm to him that they'd never heard of Jonah Lear and that they had not given him any kind of access to unreleased materials.
Okay, so now we're looking at what would seem to be an odd psychological case. I mean, Jonah Lehrer is obviously a young man of considerable talent, maybe even brilliance. Why is he doing this stuff?
I've heard a few theories floating around for the last couple of days. I mean, there's one popular theory seems to be that, you know, these mistakes were so obvious, so easily detectable, that he had to have wanted to get caught somewhere deep down. A second explanation is that, you know, Jonah Lehrer, unlike David Remnick and Malcolm Gladwell and some of the other people he's worked with, he didn't spend 10 years, 15 years at the Washington Post or the New York Times, like, learning how to be a journalist, and therefore perhaps didn't go through the kind of early terrifying days of being a reporter and, you know, making an error and having to put through a correction and deal with the wrath of your editors. So he kind of went from school to writing, you know, for blogs, writing books. He just jumped right in and became a media celebrity, and in a way that is, you know, was very savvy. He certainly learned how to elevate himself to a high profile, doing, you know, speaking gigs, and you know, ended up at the New Yorker by the age of 30. So,
and when you mention speaking gigs, we don't mean, you know, you take the subway uptown and somebody hands you a check for $200 when it's done, or maybe takes you out to dinner because they can't afford to pay you anything. We're not talking about that.
No, we're talking about talking to a bunch of hedge fund guys, you know, for $75,000 a pop. I mean, there are many people who are on the, you know, this increasingly lucrative speaking circuit now, where, you know, you could easily make $500,000 in 6 months if you're really kind of at the top of your game. And Jonah Lehrer was definitely part of that. You know, he would speak to corporations, to hedge funds, to big financial services firms.
He was kind of a big ticket guy, right?
And it was, you know, he made a lot of money doing it. So it probably paid much better than anything else that he was doing.
What does the immediate future hold for him? David Remnick, the great and esteemed editor at The New Yorker, did say publicly, I think, that Jonah Lehrer had resigned from the magazine. His publisher is going to withdraw his book, which had been in our bestseller list, still is. What's next for Jonah Lehrer?
Probably being hunkered down for a while and dealing with lawyers. And, you know, his publisher, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, has to deal with a very big mess here. I mean, they have already sold 200,000 copies of his latest book. Just this week now, in a couple of days after this happened, the publisher said that they would refund the money for anyone who wanted a refund.
This happened with James Frey, too, didn't it, Julie?
Yes. So the publisher is kind of dealing with the fallout. You know, there could be, you know, 20,000 copies of Imagine sitting in an Ingram warehouse somewhere. So they have to get those books back or get them pulped. And this hurts for many reasons, I'm sure, for Houghton Mifflin. But it especially hurts because this was a book that was doing really well for them and they were making money. Secondly, I don't know what Jonah Lehrer is going to do next. But if he follows the James Frey model, he'll be quiet for about 5 years and then make his big comeback. I mean, I have heard a couple of people say, look, there are already enough apologists out there, people who have felt sorry for Jonah Lehrer, people who have a lot of sympathy for him, that it's really only a matter of when he will come back, not if.
Thanks so much, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
As this election season heats up, the question of income inequality has become ever larger, particularly for Democrats. There's a new book by very distinguished economist Joseph Stiglitz. It's called The Price of Inequality, and it's reviewed for us this week by another distinguished man, Thomas Burns Edsel, who is a columnist for The New York Times and also a professor at the Columbia School of Journalism. He joins me from Washington. Welcome, Tom.
Good to be with you.
Okay, we have seen, as you point out in your review, a number of books by some quite skilled journalists and authors on this question of growing inequality in income. And now Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel laureate, has written what you say is the most comprehensive book on the subject. What's he saying exactly?
Well, he is joining a group of people. Lawrence Lessig is another. Paul Krugman is another. Jacob Hacker at Yale is another one of this group, arguing that inequality is actually undermining the free market, that when you concentrate wealth and you concentrate income to such a degree as we have now, that results in political power being concentrated, and the holders of that political power are going to use it to protect what they have, and which basically amounts to preventing competitors from joining in. And so it becomes a vicious circle, and the proponents of free markets turn out to be, in this argument, really advocates of a fixed market.
And what kind of evidence does Stiglitz use? Is it mathematical and econometric evidence, or is he looking at the politics of the last decade or so? How does he make his case?
It's not a mathematical or economic book with a lot of equations and hard-to-follow stuff for the layman. It's actually the whole book is quite readable. His argument is based on examining how those at the top have used their wealth, trying to actually demonstrate it. In fact, from the housing crisis to tax policy to the deregulation policies, to the fiscal deregulation in particular, where those who have the power and have the money and have the wealth have used it politically to their own advantage to further concentrate that wealth. And he makes a pretty effective argument that way.
Two questions that kind of go together. First, who is he talking about, really? We've heard a lot about the 1% or the 99%. He seems to be talking about really super wealthy people. That's question number one. And two, how long has this been going on, this control or undue influence they've gained over regulation and policy in our government?
He argues that it's been a sort of a two-step process, and a lot of it has to do with the intellectual capture of elites as opposed to just the political power of the wealthy. The Chicago School, its rising power and its advocacy of sort of pure free market thinking, in combination with the rise within the Democratic Party, really, of a neoliberal movement, especially people under Bill Clinton, Bob Rubin is probably the most famous of those, who were similarly proponents of open free markets, opening free trade, and ending much of the regulatory system governing financial practices. It's actually a more elaborate argument than just rich people stamping their own goals onto policy. There is a broader intellectual capture process that is also very interesting to read about.
Tom, I remember you probably do too, after the terrible crash of 2008, there was some soul searching that went on among journalists, at least, who looked very hard at the Chicago School of Thought. Those who were convinced that markets were this self-regulating mechanism and that should be left to themselves. And I remember, for instance, the journalist, fine reporter John Cassidy at The New Yorker actually walked the halls at the University of Chicago interviewing one Nobel laureate after another, asking them what went wrong. And I'm wondering now, you follow this so closely, it's 4 years later, isn't there still some remaining skepticism about just how effective that kind of argument is, how valid and plausible it is, given the failures in the stock market and the damage it's done to our economy?
The argument has been undermined and weakened. I think these arguments are such that both sides have points. I hate to say that in an equivocal fashion, but the basic case made pre, say, 2008 is a much harder case to make now. But the political power, though, behind it, and you can see this in the adamant efforts in Congress to protect tax breaks for those at the very top, the anti-regulatory point of view, the attempt to undermine the Dodd-Frank legislation without any corrective policies, really just to assault it. the political strength behind this remains quite strong, and in a certain sense, the intellectual capture has been replaced by a growing political capture, particularly of the political right.
Tom, in the end, many of these issues will be decided by voters. Do you have a sense? I mean, you've been writing, you know, really fine and closely detailed analyses of the left and the right, the ideological differences and divides. Do we have a sense of where the so-called, maybe mythical, independent voter might be on an issue like this? Is he going to find Stiglitz persuasive? Will he find him ideological or too far to the left? How do Americans who don't know all the details, all the policy and regulation, the intellectual capital that's being dispersed, how do they figure into all of this?
I think that a lot of the arguments that Stiglitz and this sort of intellectual movement on the left, those arguments do have a fair amount of credibility, public credibility. But liberalism itself still has a larger threshold problem. And that's one that getting these arguments across encounters a hurdle that a lot of these people don't anticipate, because they're not in the nitty-gritty trenches of politics where particularly race and class and other differences play a much stronger force and produce different intellectual responses by the electorate.
So then for politicians, there's kind of a balancing act they have to manage between these fairly complex and perhaps ideologically driven arguments and just the responses that ordinary voters will make.
Yes, I think if you look at Massachusetts, for example, Elizabeth Warren running for Senate there makes a lot of arguments that I suspect a lot of voters would share. But a lot of voters at the same time see her as kind of an elitist, and the regular Joe Sixpack kind of voter is wary of her for reasons that involve all kinds of other factors besides pure economics, even though her arguments compared to Scott Brown's on economics might be on their face better accepted by the South Boston guy who works in construction. This is another whole argument, but it's just that there are really problems on the left that have yet to be addressed.
Well, maybe that will be a subject for our next conversation. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
That's Thomas B. Edsel, a New York Times columnist and professor of journalism at Columbia, who reviews The Price of Inequality by Joseph Stiglitz in this week's book review. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
How you doing, Sam?
What's new on the list this week?
Well, on the fiction side of things, Gillian Flynn's Gone Girl still leads the top of the list. But just below that, new on the list at number two is Emily Giffen's Where We Belong, about an 18-year-old girl trying to track down her birth mother.
Giffen's built up quite a following, right? A book every other year or so, and does very well with young women.
It's kind of smart chick lit that her first two books, Something Borrowed and Something Blue, were very much about kind of women getting started in life on the career path, on the family path. And since then, she's built a real following. Each of her last, I think this is the third book in a row to hit the list at number two. She's never had a number one bestseller, but she sells very well. Yeah. Then at number three, Danielle Steele, who also has quite a following, debuts on the list this week with Friends Forever, a story of three boys and two girls who've been friends since kindergarten.
You have to hand it to her. It's novel after novel for many, many years now.
Yeah, often about kind of the high life. And you interviewed her a few years ago, didn't you?
Yes, we had a lovely conversation. I think it was on the phone, but it was terrific.
Then at number four, new on the list this week, is Brad Thor's Blacklist. That's the latest novel in his Scott Harvath series. At number six, also a series novel, Tana French's Broken Harbor. It's from her Dublin Murder Squad series. At number 11, again, a serious novel, J.A. Jantz's Judgment Call, which is about the Arizona sheriff, Joanna Brady. And then at the bottom of the list, another serious novel, Kelly Armstrong's 13, which concludes her Women of the Otherworld fantasy series.
And nonfiction?
On the nonfiction side, Cheryl Strayed's Wild is still at number one. The new books on the list this week are starting at number six, Tom Fitton's The Corruption Chronicles. Fitton is the president of Judicial Watch, which is a kind of a conservative website that they do a lot of freedom of information requests. They try to root out corruption and make the case for small government and against activist judges and that kind of thing. At number eight, the liberal reporter, journalist Chris Hedges and comics artist Joe Sacco collaborated on a book called Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, where they traveled around the country to different what they call sacrifice zones, different regions that they say capitalism has just destroyed. So a coal mining town in West Virginia, the abandoned inner city of Camden, New Jersey. They say in these places, corporations came in, used the resources, used the people for their own ends. And once they'd kind of burned through it all, then they left again and left everything in a shambles.
Anything else?
Yeah. Neil Barofsky is new on the list with a book called Bailout. Barofsky used to be a federal prosecutor, and he oversaw the administration of the TARP money, the bank bailout money, and became very disillusioned with what he saw as basically a giveaway to Wall Street. He tried to scale back bonuses to the banks, things like that, and he just found resistance every step of the way in the government, and this is his kind of tell-all about that experience. Then finally, the last new book on the list this week at number 15 is Sam Keen's The Violinist's Thumb. Keen is a young science writer. He's 33 years old, whose earlier book, which was called The Disappearing Spoon, looked at the periodic elements and through case histories to try to see what they tell us about whichever element of science he's looking at right now. And in this new book, The Violinist's Thumb, it's DNA and genes.
And is he a trained scientist?
Yeah, he studied physics and English. He was a double major at his college in Minnesota. But he's very good at kind of bringing science to life through the human element. The violinist that he's referring to in The Violinist's Thumb is Niccolo Paganini, who an Italian violinist from the late 1700s into the mid-1800s.
Who was the greatest of all virtuosos.
Yes. He was so great that when he died, the church wouldn't bury him for years because they thought he had made a deal with the devil to become so talented. And in fact, what Keen says is he very probably had a genetic disorder that gave him extreme flexibility in his joints and his thumbs and fingers that made him just a more accomplished violinist than somebody without that disorder could have become. And this book looks at a lot of people. It goes into crazy cat ladies and looks at what the genetic basis for that might be. It looks at Tsutomu Yamaguchi, who died a couple of years ago. He's the man who survived Hiroshima and then got on a train that night and went home to Nagasaki and was there for that bomb as well. And he lived until 2010. So Sam Keen looks at what might have been in his genetic makeup that helped him repair whatever damage the nuclear bombs would have caused.
Thanks so much, Greg.
Thank you, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.